The dark days are done, and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true, I love you.
Thank you, Doc. Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
That was Sarita singing Sunny to me, and Frank Sinatra once again introducing me when he hosted The Tonight Show. This is John Barber. Welcome to John Barber's World on this Memorial Day. This is one of the most traveled holidays of the year, and millions of us, millions of you especially, were caught in airport mob scenes that looked like a Walmart TV sale. You know, if this is the land of the free enterprise and competition, I do not understand why Americans put up with TSA, the government, and unnecessary long lines at airports. I mean, free enterprise means that they should be out of there and each airline should set up its own security. This would obviously increase competition, shorten lines, and probably lower prices. What has TSA accomplished? They have spent $5 billion to give jobs and uniforms to people who would have a tough time getting hired at Popeye's Chicken. TSA has spent $5 billion since 911 and have caught not one terrorist, but what they have caught is 897 thieves wearing these new uniforms. Sadly, weather-wise, some of you have been caught in terrible tornadoes and a couple of mild hurricanes. You know, the next time a big hurricane runs through the country and goes around wrecking everything, they should not give this a woman's name again. They should give it a man's name. They should call it Trump. Everywhere he goes now, it's a shambles from San Diego to New Mexico. Right now, he can't stop shooting off his mouth and firing blanks. This is what he said a few weeks ago was his favorite Bible verse, and it's not even in the Bible. Quote, give a man a fish and he eats for a day. Deport him, he has to learn to fish for himself. Do you realize that just a short 6 months ago, there were 16 of these Bible-sprouting Republican candidates, each one, with, I must say, the exception of Donald, from Carson to Rubio to Bush to Cruz, every second sentence was saying that he was running and doing the work God told them to do. And except for Donald, they're all gone. It is God's, folks. It is God's ever-silent way of saying absolutely nothing to any living human being, pope or politician. It's his silent way of saying, you're all full of shit. Anyway, this Memorial Day, most of us were sending good thoughts or and memories or visiting graves of our fallen men and women in our military. And some of us, like myself, will also be remembering those criminal presidents who lied them into their graves. May the soldiers' souls rest in peace. May the souls of Bush and Lyndon Johnson absolutely rot in hell. And speaking of hell and good and God, I was on Rents Friday night, 9 o'clock, late Friday night, and told this little story, and scores of you wished I would retell it. You sent me Facebook notes and emails. So to lighten the mood and to prepare to talk to the only guest we've ever had back for a third time, because you, like I really respect and admire him and his unbelievable work in his book. So here it is. St. Peter is sitting at the pearly gates. Two guys from Ferguson arrive, wearing dark hoodies and sagging pants. St. Peter looks out through the gates and says, "Oh, wait here, I'll be right back." So St. Peter goes over to God's chambers and tells him who's waiting at the entrance. And God says to Peter, "Pete, how many times do I have to tell you? You can't be judgmental here. This is heaven. All are loved. All are brothers. Go back and let them in." So Peter goes back to the gates, looks around, and lets out a heavy sigh. And he returns to God's chambers and says, "Well, they're all gone." And God says, "The guys wearing hoodies?" And Peter says, "No, the pearly gates." Anyway, that's it. Thanks for asking. And now to a man I told you has been back for the third time. The first time he was here was unbelievable. It was about his book, The FBI's War on Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders. And then another book, the second time he was here, it was about drugs as weapons against us. We only barely got started, and everybody wanted to have him back again. So here he is, our very favorite and most popular guest, John L. Potes. John, how are you and where are you tonight?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on again. I'm flattered that you are having me on for the third time in an unprecedented way. I'm in Baltimore. I'm at home in Baltimore.
And I didn't bring it up, but you bring it up. When you're not writing, what are you doing?
I work as a counselor. I counsel people with mental health issues and with an expertise in addictions.
Well, that's truly admirable of you. And your book is just astonishing. I've read it three times. We barely got through the first third of it. I mean, it was kind of haphazard. The wonderful thing about the book, you could open it any place and have an absolutely fabulous and interesting and often shocking read. The one person that we didn't get to and I wanted to ask you about was the artist that I think has been throughout history the greatest performing artist in America, who was also a political activist, and that was Paul Robeson. Mm. And the question I had to ask is, could you tell me, was that one of the early incidences where the government used drugs on an artist activist? And then before you answer that question, some might say that John Lennon is probably the greatest artist activist in America, but we imported him from England, as we did Thomas Paine, who was the intellectual founder of the American Revolution, writing Common Sense. So could you do me a favor? At the beginning of the book, you have these wonderful introductory quotes. Now, John himself was somebody who obviously experienced drugs, but read what he said about taking drugs, John.
Sure. John Lennon said, "The basic thing nobody asks is, why do people take drugs of any sort? Why do we have these accessories to normal living to live? I mean, is there something wrong with society that's making us so pressurized that we cannot live without guarding ourselves against it?"
That is so terrific. Now, for Paul Robeson, tell us about who Paul Robeson was, what he did, and why the government tried to silence him.
Yeah, I think Robeson wasn't the earliest artist targeted in my book, as an example in my book, but he was, with drugs, that is. But he was one of the earliest artists that I cover being targeted in general, because he was targeted from a very early age, being a black activist man. He was, the first artist targeted in general, but with drugs, through MK Ultra, he was targeted in 1961. And I document how I think Elvis Presley was targeted in the mid 1950s, or about 1956. It probably started against him with this Colonel Tom Parker. Now, with Paul Robeson, though, he was probably... Well,
hold it a second. We'll get back to Paul Robeson. You brought up Elvis, and you know when I put on Facebook that you were going to be here, somebody sent me a note saying that the Elvis stuff is really interesting. I had no idea, even though I've read half the book about Elvis. So why? I mean, he was not an activist of any sort, and his manager, it always staggered me that I used to see Elvis perform at the International Hilton here in Vegas. He was trim, and I'm not a fan of his records, but nobody on stage performed like this man. No white man performed like Elvis. He was wonderful. I always wondered why Colonel Parker, who was getting 50% of this man, allowed him to go to pot, as it were, and allowed him to go to drugs. Now, did Colonel Sanders have anything to do with this? Why would the government target Elvis?
Yeah, and I argue that for his time, he actually was an activist without even realizing it. You know, the head of the American Indian Movement, a guy named John Trudell, was a very serious activist, was highly respected in the activist movements of the 1970s, and was targeted. When he burned a flag on the Capitol steps, within hours, his whole house was burned down, and he lost his mother, his wife, and his three kids. I think it was three kids in that house, and it was absolutely tragic. And he gave up activism after that and turned it to to music. And he put out an album called Graffiti Man that Jackson Browne produced, and on that album, he has a song called Baby Che, talking about Che Guevara.
Uh-huh.
And he actually called Elvis Presley Baby Che Guevara. And the reason he says he did that in that song is because he thinks that Elvis revolutionized the way men express their emotions. He said before Elvis, it was hard for him and a lot of other men he knew to be expressive with their emotions. And Elvis freed him and other men he knew to express their emotions so, outright and publicly, and, to cry in public and all that. And that's what he thought of Elvis.
John, that's certainly is true, but that's because it was a white man. But you can go back 4 years and find out that blacks express their emotions better than
And I
Elvis.
Agree with that. I agree with you about that. Now, the problem was, one issue with that was that black music was censored from, white airwaves for the most part. And the second aspect of that is the fact that Elvis always said, I'm not the king of rock and roll. People like Bo Diddley and B.B. King and people like that are the kings of rock and roll, not me. And he always went to black concerts. He constantly, broke all segregationist bands, and he tried to do whatever he could in that regard. And that was a problem for the oligarchs, I argue, who were trying to enforce segregation and were trying to stop the listening to this, to black music and all that, and trying to ban them from the airwaves. And so I argue for those reasons, they thought Elvis was a threat, for all the reasons stated. And so they wanted to control him. And the way they did is they got the highest ranking member of the National Guard, which was Colonel Tom Parker's position at the time. They placed him in his life to take over it when Elvis was only 21 years old.
Okay.
And then
let me ask you,
at speed and downers consistently.
Okay. Now, Colonel Parker, wasn't he the guy that became wealthy with a product called Hadacol?
That's possible. I don't know that much about him besides the fact that he was the highest.
It was a product advertised, I believe, on television as sort of a cure-all. And he owned it, and I think it was like 14 or 16% alcohol, and they couldn't sell it anymore. Okay, then how could the government and the establishment get a Colonel Parker assigned to Elvis, and why would Elvis accept somebody who's going to take 50% of his earnings?
Well, Elvis didn't have managers that could control his instant fame. His fame was meteoric and so fast that no one could control the way, had the connections to get him booked all over the place, to get him, to handle the touring and the instant fame. But at the same time, also, there were lots of radio stations that were banning his music. Now people were rioting. I literally, kids were throwing rocks through windows saying, play Elvis or else know, tear up this town. So it was, so he, you know, there was, they need, Elvis thought he might need someone who can make, you know, make the connections and really get things going because of all the things.
But at one time, John, mm-hmm. he went and visited Richard Nixon, said he wanted to sign up as a FBI agent or a CIA asset or something like that.
And that was after Tom Parker took control. And that was after he went to Germany. So John Lennon had a famous quote about Elvis. He said that people kept hounding him when Elvis died. Reporters hounded him. Can you give us a quote about what you thought about Elvis's death? And he said, finally, he said, you know, look, Elvis to me died when he went into the army in Germany. After that, he was just the living dead, you know. And so he basically thought that Elvis was incredible before he went to Germany. But after Germany, he was basically, he lost himself. And I show MKUltra had incredible operations going on in Germany, operations that were so horrible that a top guy, whose name leaves me right at the moment, but a top scientist, his name is Frank Olson, was part of MKUltra, worked for Fort Detrick near me here in Maryland, and he got pushed out of a 10-story window and killed after they first tried to dose him with acid because he was leaving MKUltra. He was leaving his position, and you weren't allowed to leave a position that was so secretive and so doing so much dastardly deeds. And one of the top reasons he said, according to people close to him, you know, according to a movie about him, was that he was so sickened by what he saw going on in Germany with his with the MKUltra operations in Germany. You know, they were torturing people to death. They were doing all kinds of unbelievably horrible operations. Really, you know, Nazi type operations just continued in Germany, but under MKUltra.
It's probably worse today. But you know, you may have answered my question, because I always wondered how could Colonel Parker let this man die in front of his very eyes, and maybe he didn't mind that Elvis died. Maybe he was there to help do him in, because the Elvis estate probably makes more now than it did when he was the Walking Dead.
Yeah, they didn't. You know, he actually controlled his life so much that he didn't allow him to be in a live concert for about 10 years, from about 1958 to 1968 is what I read. You know, he just controlled his life. He wouldn't let him in. You know, he was supposed to be. He was offered so many movie roles, such as A Star Is Born and West Side Story, and he wouldn't let him be in any movies but these canned movies, you know. So,
you know what? Why hasn't that been made into a movie? I mean, they've done these trashy bios of him and these videos of him. I mean, this is just an unbelievable American story. Even the Colonel Parker part of the story. Colonel Parker's a story in himself. I mean, it's horrifying. John, you are so interesting. Now let's get back to Paul Robeson. Okay, first, before we leave Elvis, when he died, mm-hmm. do you think he overdosed himself? Do you think he was murdered? What do you think happened?
Yeah, apparently he was prescribed so much speed and so many downers, and he was just so strung out on those things. So it's hard to know exactly how he died, but it's likely from, you know, it's like just a pharmaceutical overload that just, you know, did him in. But it's not sure. It's not certain how exactly, you know, he died besides that. I mean, that's what they, you know, they found. They found that, you know, he had so many prescriptions of these drugs. And the guy that was prescribing all those drugs was later found to be, you know, just breaking, you know, medical ethics. And was taken to court for you know just over prescribing, but I argue that was so much later that they just gave up on that guy who was doing the bidding of MKUltra. But he constantly had people from Germany, from the war, you know, when he was over in Germany, surrounding him. They called him the Memphis Mafia. These guys.
Yes, I remember that. Well, this is not in your book, but mm-hmm. the recent demise of Prince. And I keep reading stuff on the internet, and it's difficult to decide which is true and which is not, that supposedly the police are investigating it as a homicide. What are your thoughts on the death of Prince?
Yeah, well, I actually have maybe just one page about Prince being targeted in my book, Death Be Our Warrants, Box Four and Black Leaders. And it was just when Death Row Records, there's two ways I think I mentioned him being targeted, which in the first book, which is Death Row Records people, you know, Suge Knight and other people, the police officers obviously, but undercover police officers went and tore up Prince's club in Minneapolis and sent two of the bouncers to the hospital and didn't get any trouble for it, as they never do because they're undercover agent police officers. But so there was that, and then the fact that Time Warner would not allow him to use his own name anymore. They said, we have your name under contract. You're not allowed to use your name anymore. And then, of course, their Time Warner's assets and the magazines and media made fun of Prince for using the name artist formerly known as Prince, just, you know, pretending like he's crazy versus he's not allowed to use his name anymore. But Prince was a surprising amount of activism that, because he was a Jehovah's Witness, he wasn't allowed to talk about it all. You know, he was just supposed to do the activism and not, you know, preach it or not talk about it according to his religion. And so he, I didn't know that about him before he died. And that's pretty wild to hear. And you can hear that from some of these Van Jones, I think his name is, who used to work for the Obama administration, talked about that. So it's pretty wild how much activism he was doing behind the scenes.
It was reported that a week before he died, he gave $50,000 to the 911 Truthers movement.
Oh, wow. I didn't hear that. I know he did benefit concerts for the protesters in Baltimore and for the Black Lives Movement in general. Yeah.
Well, doing that is enough to get him serious attention from the federal government.
Right.
I am reading a William Pepper's book now, The Death of a King. My God, it's just astonishing. I mean, the facts behind the government's murder of Martin Luther King. But now, to get back to Paul Robeson, this monumental talent, this monumental activist, this great voice, internationally known and admired.
He was an unbelievable man, yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, he was just such an unbelievable man. I mean, arguably one of the most incredible men in history, because he spoke, they say he spoke, some 20 languages. You know, yeah. He could talk to people in 20 different languages. He graduated from Columbia Law School. He was a top athlete, you know, an All-American football player, they say, a great lacrosse player. He had so many talents. It was just amazing. And he was also a great activist. You know, he was a great civil rights activist before civil rights even became popular. He was an activist for unions. He regularly sang for unions, you know, labor movements.
And you know something with that evidence that Paul Robeson was a much more courageous man than even Martin Luther King or Malcolm X, because when Martin was out there and Malcolm out there, they had thousands of people marching with them. Paul Robeson stood absolutely alone.
That's true, yeah. I didn't think about it that way. That's a good point. I'm sorry about this phone. I wish I knew how to keep this.
Oh, don't be silly. Don't be silly.
So, yeah, it's going to bother us for a moment. But, yeah, he was. That's I completely agree with you that he's an incredible man. And, you know, incredibly courageous that, yeah, he stood up there alone on stage. Okay. What he did, got attacked, yeah.
How did the government do him in?
Well, first they took away his passport, and they did things to him that way, and so. But the biggest thing they did with MKUltra was, according to Paul Robeson Jr., who was an adult when this happened, he said that they got a call about the fact that his dad was in the Soviet Union. He was 3 weeks away from meeting. He was supposed to meet with Che Guevara and Fidel Castro in 3 weeks, and he was doing a concert in the Soviet Union, and he was at an American hotel where he was staying, and there some people that were associated with the government were staying in the room right next to him, and they were having a party, and so a bunch of these people, just, you know, right-wing, actually, you know, government folks, were trying to convince him to come to this party, and finally said, all right, I'll just stop in and have, you know, one drink. And he goes in there, and somebody doses his drink with a mega, you know, a load of psychedelics. Now, Paul Robeson Jr. has kind of gone back and forth about whether it was LSD or a even more powerful psychedelic called BZ. But either way, they dosed him with a huge psychedelic, and when he came to, he felt suicidal. He didn't know what was going on. Nobody, not many people knew about psychedelics back then, 1961. And so, Paul Robeson Jr. came over to see what was happening with his father. And when he got there and to the hotel, somebody dosed him too, dosed his drink, dropped acid or in his drink. And he said, he thought he just had a huge amount of LSD that they put in his drink, and he luckily just had a sip and was tripping, but not tripping for days, just tripping for some hours. And so it was really tough, and they kept doing it to his dad, and they tried to do it to him again too. And eventually his dad just thought he was losing his mind, and people convinced him to go into a mental hospital. And once they got him in a mental hospital, in Britain, they basically coerced his wife into allowing him to get electric shock treatment. And then they kept him there for 2.5 years, giving him 50-plus electric shock treatments, likely at higher doses than you're supposed to. And they basically really hurt his mind with both the psychedelics and the electric shock treatment.
So what has always surprised me, they've done a movie about Malcolm X with Denzel Washington, a pretty decent movie. Ordinary films about Martin Luther King. I have often wondered why the black elite, from Oprah to Spike Lee to Denzel Washington to all of these people, why they have not either made a one-man show for Broadway out of Paul Robeson's life story, or why they have not made a monumental film. Because one of the really moving stories I read about Paul, if you don't mind my telling it quickly, after they had taken away his passport, he had been booked. He had been booked in Vancouver, Canada, for a concert. And it was for miners and strikers and labor unions. And they had about 10, 12, 15,000 sales. The U.S. government would not let him cross the border into Vancouver, so they could not have him in Vancouver on a stage performing. So what he did and what his associates did, they stood him about 10 feet from the Canadian border. They had publicized all over Canada that he would be performing. For hundreds of yards along the border, they put up loudspeakers. And he sang for an hour and a half to 25,000 Canadians.
That's wild.
Isn't that a story for a movie? In the case of Janis Joplin, she never struck me.
Before you get to Janis Joplin, let me just tell you. I've talked to people who have tried desperately to make a movie about Paul Robeson, and they said that when they would get someone powerful to back them, like Richard Pryor got attacked in some way, shape, or form. And so there was different, there were many efforts to make movies about Paul Robeson, is my understanding, but the powers that be seemed to come down to not let that it happen, so. There's yet more stories even behind that.
Well, it would be nice. It's not a nice thing to say, but maybe somebody else besides Richard set fire to himself.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
I knew him extremely well. As a matter of fact, when I had first come up with the concept for Real People, and I had it for sale, or I had it first with ABC. And I remember the guy's name, Lou Ehrlich, who was head of programming. And I wanted Richard Pryor to be my co-host. I wanted him to be my Byron Allen. At the time, he was about to go to jail for beating up an NBC executive who censored a scene from out of his special, and he had refused to pay his income taxes because he didn't want to support any wars. So he was in deep trouble. And I told it, and Lou Ehrlich looked at me and he says, "That nigger's never getting on this network." And I said, "Listen, I'm telling you, Lou, I know he's in trouble, but when he goes to Oakland, he puts 10,000 asses in seats. That kid's going to be a big star, and he was. Anyway, okay, to the point of Janis Joplin, it never struck me that Janis did anything except she was really quite a phenomenal entertainer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she agreed to do these unprecedented stadium anti-war concerts. There's supposed to be two of them. There's supposed to be one in New York and one in Philadelphia. And there was no concerts like that, that large, you know, really just strictly anti-war and preaching anti-war messages and all that, believe it or not. All the other concerts weren't, you know, people think of them as being that, but they weren't. They wouldn't allow people like Abbie Hoffman to come on stage and speak at Woodstock, for example. You know, they weren't that. They weren't saying that. They weren't, you know, outright anti-war concerts. And so she was doing something that she announced on Merv Griffin. She'd been on Merv Griffin, you know, several times. She was, just on different shows like that. I mean, announcing these anti-war concerts, and it was going to raise a huge amount of money for the anti-war movement. And so I argue that that, along with some of her earlier fame, just being such a talent and a woman who was going to break in, who was kind of uncontrolled at that time, is why she was targeted. You know, she was targeted earlier on.
When somebody is that famous, though, they have this moat of bodyguards around them. How would somebody from the government, somebody undercover, how would they get to her to drug her?
No, well, what it was is she had an addiction. You know, this first fiance had given her speed again and again and developed a speed habit, you know, in her. And he said he was working for that. He told another girlfriend that he had worked for the FBI. And if you look at his history, you can see he was a high level intelligence officer of some sort by his history. But he so he had started her on drug addiction. So she had problems with addiction. She wouldn't use LSD. She hated LSD. And, you know, one time she tried it, she hated it. And, you know, that was known. But she had a problem with, you know, people had gotten to her with other drugs and she developed problems with it. She tried to clean up from heroin, but she got clean for a while and then got relapsed. So the problem was, according to her sister, is that her sister said she thinks the CIA killed her. And it's partly because everyone who had that, who got heroin from that dealer died. They gave, basically, that dealer started giving out a pure batch of heroin. You know, usually heroin is only 5 or 10% pure at most. But if you get it up to 50 to 60, even 80, 90%, whatever, it's kind of laboratory grade heroin. Then,
you know, they probably offed Lenny Bruce that way too.
It's possible. Yeah.
Okay, to you personally, what was the most shocking, the most surprising, the most upsetting story that you told in this book?
Well, I like, you know, of course, I really love John Lennon too, like you did. But I, for some reason, Cobain was more my, you know, he's only than me. It was more my generation. So that, you know, was the that was probably the most shocking, because he was just, he was very unique, very sharp, very, really groundbreaking in the sense that he just, you know, was like leading so many people into this anti-materialist kind of mode and this activist kind of mode, in my mind, the way he thought about things. And I think he, you know, to the fact that they used, and I show the evidence to this, and I know it's going to sound crazy to some listeners who haven't read my book, but the evidence points to the fact that they used an MKUltra woman to become pregnant with him. That was Courtney Love, pregnant with his kids, with his kid, Francis Bean Cobain, and then proceed to help do him in when he was leaving her, when he was officially divorcing her and was going to, you know, do his own thing. And he had gotten clean and sober from heroin. And so, yeah, that was, for some reason, the way, how complicated that was and the way it was done to him. And it was the hardest to convey in a clear way, but at the same time, it was also the most shocking to me, because it kind of uncovered, wow, how many of these Courtney Love type individuals are out there and you know, promoted to this fame that she's like she was promoted to.
How did Cobain die?
Well, they say he shot himself and killed himself that way, but they also, you know, according to lab reports and all, he also had three times the amount of heroin that would kill a severe addict instantly. And so you've got, you know, people like the top, you know, the president of the American Pathology Association, Cyril Wecht, who's a regular on CNN, who says, you know, the whole way that the Cobain case was investigated was completely inappropriate. You do not announce that the way someone died the same day that he's found. He says it takes weeks to get back lab tests and everything else. And this is, and he says he's never seen anybody in his 80, you know, he's about 82 years old. He's never seen anyone in his 50 to 60 year career ever shoot themselves, you know, kill themselves after shooting up heroin. He says that does not happen, you know, because heroin produces euphoria in people. And so he says, you know, and he says that much heroin, you know, in your system at once would make it extremely hard, you know, to it would instantly, you know, incapacitate you in seconds, you know, not minutes. And it would be very hard to pick up a shotgun and then shoot yourself. You know, he says, is it impossible? No, but it'd be extremely hard. And the whole situation is something he's never seen before. And it's, you know, kind of virtually impossible to imagine.
John, you are incredibly, incredibly interesting, incredibly verbal. Your book is absolutely wonderful. I told you I've been through it two or three times. I keep going back to it. Where can people get your book, and where can the people get the other book about the FBI?
Sure. You can get Drugs as Weapons Against Us, and the subtitle for people who haven't heard about it before. It's the CIA's Murderous Targeting of SDS, Panthers, Hendrix, Lennon, Cobain, Tupac, and Other Activists. And Barnes & Noble carry it, usually about at least one to three Barnes & Nobles around every city. And they say if it's not on the shelf, they can get it on the shelf in 2 to 3 days. Amazon, you know, sells it, of course. Barnes & Noble Online sells it too. And if you want an autographed copy or some of my other merchandise, you can go to drugsasweapons.com. And the first book, The FBI War on Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders, is available on Amazon or, again, you know, my website, you know, drugsasweapons.com. Okay.
Well, John, thank you so much. You will be back a fourth time.
And, thank you so much, John.
And I don't know if I meant to send you Joe Satilli's News Vandal. I will send it to you daily until you subscribe to it. It is the very best independent newsletter in America. And he, Joe, as you know, is a regular on our guest. We're going to take a break now and come back with Joe. But again, thank you so very much. We will be talking to you a fourth time.
That'd be great. It was great talking to you, John. Bye-bye.
Thanks. We'll be right back with Joe.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Hi, this is John Barber of John Barber's World every other Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific right here on BBS Radio. I'm telling you about a terrific show, The New Criminal Minds, with outstanding actor Gary Sinise, called Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, a tough drama about a special unit of the FBI involved in protecting Americans who are beyond borders. It follows the regular Criminal Minds, airing every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. Don't miss it. Gary Sinise is outstanding.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with Prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Thank you for that smile upon your face, oh sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World. Welcome back to John Barber's World. This is John, and I want to thank again George Knapp for that wonderful, wonderful endorsement of The Last Word on the Assassination, which you can get at Amazon, and the sales of which are helping us move forward with part two. And one of the people working very closely with me on this and who is indispensable is my regular here, the author and the journalist who does the very best newsletter in the country. It's called News Vandal, and it's Joe Satilli. Joe, how are you? While we were waiting to come back on, I asked you if there was something in the News Vandal that you wanted to touch on right away, and you said you wanted to follow up a bit on something that John Potash was talking about.
Yeah, well, we do have to talk a little bit about Memorial Day or the Memorial Days that America seems to be in. And isn't it odd that we celebrate or we remember all of the soldiers who died ostensibly to protect our freedom by burning animals and drinking beer? But the thing that I wanted to follow up on was about Paul Robeson. And this is something that you've talked about many times with me off air. I know this is a particular interest to you because Paul Robeson, as it's a sentiment John Potash actually shares, this is one of the titanic figures in American history, and it's somebody that most people don't know anything about. Well, Steve McQueen, and we're not talking about action star from the 60s. Steve McQueen is the director of 12 Years a Slave. And for the last 2 years, he has been trying to get a biopic off the ground about Paul Robeson. And at one point, I had read that Harry Belafonte had signed on to the film. He still has not gotten the film made. But in the interim, he launched an art project a couple months ago in New York called End Credits. And in this move, in this presentation, he went through as much of the material as he could, detailing FBI surveillance of Paul Robeson over the course of his life.
Wow!
Through Freedom of Information Act, and so you would go into a museum space, and he would have the documents come up on a large screen, and a number of actors signed on to read from the surveillance notes and from the documents that the FBI had collected. And McQueen was he's apparently obsessed with Robeson, obviously based on this project. He had spent 6 years going through material just for this project alone. He said that the amount of material that the FBI has on Robeson is astonishing. That's the word he used. And in fact, 2 years after Robeson died in 76, they were still monitoring and surveilling all of Robeson's associates.
Oh my goodness.
That is the extent to which if you can look at it a couple ways, but one way I think it's important to look at it is the extent to which they surveilled him and made that a priority is the extent to which they thought he was a dangerous person to what they were after. He was obviously an impediment to their strategic goals.
You know to whom Steve McQueen should go? And I bet he would get the money in about 4 or 5 minutes. He should go to Putin.
Yeah.
Seriously, the Russians totally loved Paul Robeson.
Yeah, Yeah, exactly. Right. There you go. Because he's probably better known in Russia than he is in the United States.
Exactly. And I'm sure if he took this art exhibit and some of his actors to Moscow, they could make that movie in Russia and make it in English.
Oh, well, if our producer's listening, maybe get McQueen on the show to talk about this, because I can tell you, if you type in Steve McQueen, Paul Robeson, and you look for information on what he's done, this is one story I found on this epic project. It was not covered in New York newspapers. It was not covered in the Brooklyn Rail. It wasn't covered in all the places you expect. I found it on The Root, which is an African-American-themed news source. But there is basically a news blackout on an Academy Award-winning director's major art exhibit, which is unheard of, because I could tell you if Spielberg did an art exhibit, it would be all over the place.
Well, Spielberg would never do Paul Robeson.
I'm saying if Spielberg did a thing, because, you know, he likes to do that triumphalist American stuff, if he did a thing did an art project on J. Edgar Hoover, it would be covered in the media 6 ways to Sunday. The fact that this guy who won an Academy Award for directing 12 Years a Slave cannot get any coverage of this project tells you the extent to which there is this blackout on Paul Robeson.
Is Steve a white man or a black
man?
No,
he's African American.
Okay, wow. Well, I'm telling you, I'm reading. You were here a couple of weeks ago when we had William Pepper on,
yeah.
And he's going to be coming back on in a couple of weeks, and I'm reading the Murder of the King, The Killing of the King, and actually Dr. Pepper, he is a doctor. What a name, Dr. Pepper.
Well, I got a segue out of that one.
Okay. I mean, one of the brightest and most interesting men in the world, and his name is Dr. Pepper. But in any event, the sad, sad thing about the book is that blacks were as evil in participating in the murder of Martin Luther King, in the murder of Malcolm X, and in the destruction of the anti-war movement. The very blacks that would be helped by these people are killing their patriots. I mean, well, it's
you know, total. John, you know this, and from people don't know that there's a, you know, John is beginning to work on another film project. The carrots and the sticks that are offered are significant. There are significant carrots, and we're talking about 24 karat gold carrots. I mean, if you participate, if you're willing to be purchased, if you're willing to be compliant with any kind of governmental operation, and when we talk about governmental operations, we're talking about specific counterintelligence operations inside the United States run by the FBI. For many years, the CIA was active. You had COINTELPRO, which Ground Zero was here in California, and particularly Los Angeles Police Department, which was basically kind of a CIA operation. And when Ronald Reagan was governor, COINTELPRO was – he worked hand in glove, his administration did, with COINTELPRO. These kinds of counterintelligence operations inside the United States rely on turning agents, just like a John Le Carré novel, right? You're trying to get, you know, Yuri Popov to become a double agent so that you can undermine what the Soviets are doing in Central America, all that cloak and dagger stuff. That's how it works. And the sticks are so painful. And I think this is one of the reasons why when assassinations have happened, it is important that people see and feel and have a tactile experience of that assassination. It's not like something that happens traditionally in third world countries in the 20th century, when a dictator had an opponent and he would have that person assassinated and then the body would disappear for a few weeks and then it would be dug up somewhere. You want these things to be public. You want people to see them and you want people to feel them so they get the message of this is what the stick is. And oh, by the way, look at the carrot. You could actually have a 25, 30, 40-year career in the media or as a political organizer like Jesse Jackson. Or, I mean, these are people who became fabulously famous, often wealthy, and certainly had a very easy life as a result of their cooperation.
Well, I posted that wonderful, wonderful article you did about speaking of the carrot. Wonderful article you did about Chris Matthews. It is just totally brilliant. And I know that that is one of your pet peeves, even though you watch him often just to get information about politics.
Yeah, to get the rundown on what's going on every day on politics. I mean, it's not – I wouldn't call it indispensable, but based on what else is out there, you know, you get – he asks great questions to political operators because he was an insider. This is the thing is Chris Matthews worked for Tip O'Neill. And he's one of these guys who's gone from politics into journalism. I'm not fond of that happening. I don't, you know, because often the relationships persist when you go from politics to journalism. But on the Kennedy assassination, he's like sitting in the corner with his fingers in his ears going, la, 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 Oswald was the lone assassin, la, 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 la. He won't listen to anybody else on the topic. He wrote about JFK, called him the elusive hero. Well, yeah, he's elusive if you don't pay attention to the facts of his life.
In your News Vandal, you have an interesting article about abolish Memorial Day. I mean, I think I was interviewing Cindy Sheehan one night, and just off of the top of my head, I said, you know, for going to war, there are about 150 medals issued by the government and the military for going to war, but there's only one peace prize.
Yeah, well, that's a story. That's an opinion piece by Justin Raimondo over at antiwar.com. He's a libertarian, and he comes from the libertarian point of view about war and aggression, and libertarians are not fond of war and aggression. And it's really about the sacralization of death. And it's kind of incentivizing the idea of death in war. The story that really struck me today was a report in The Atlantic on a memorial in Fredericksburg, Virginia. Fredericksburg is, it's about an hour outside of Washington, D.C. I've been there a few times. And they have a war memorial there with six granite pillars. And it's tied, you know, there's a slab on top that says Our Fallen Heroes, you know, the usual fare. And on each of the pillar, you have names of the area's war dead, people from the Fredericksburg area who died in these wars, you know, World War I and World War II, Korean War, Vietnam, and there's the Global War on Terror. And then there are like six total, and there are two panels that are completely blank. And they've been left blank for whatever future wars they need to fill up with names.
Well, you know what that reminds me of? For the folks, I got stuck in traffic coming back from the golf course, which is near Hoover Dam, and you had all these people returning from Arizona, well, a couple of weeks ago. I was in Phoenix, and if you drive back, once you get past Kingman I'm trying to think of the guy with the black eyes that wears the glasses, Senator Harry Reid.
Oh, Harry
Reid. Where Harry Reid comes from. He's doing a commercial now in town, but wearing black sunglasses because he's still got black eyes from being beat up. But anyway, you drive from where it is that he was born to Hoover Dam, and you pass a highway that says something about the Civil War Highway. Then you pass one that's called the World War I Memorial Highway. Then you come to World War II Memorial Highway. Then you come to the Vietnam War Memorial Highway. And get this, the next one is the War on Terror Highway.
Oh, my goodness.
And it must be endless. It must circle the planet a half a dozen times. But it just takes you to Hoover Dam. I mean, it's like a Peter Sellers movie, for Christ's sake.
It is. It is. And, you know, it's getting even more comical now because we had Budweiser changing its name to America a few weeks ago as a promotional sort of leverage off of the Trump candidacy. Well, now Coke is doing the same thing. They are now dressing the cans in the flag. And they are featuring a lyric from a Lee Greenwood song that's played at every small town 4th of July 4th fireworks display. I'm proud to be an American.
Well, you know, I thought Okay, I thought Budweiser did that because they were bought by a foreign company.
No. They're obviously trying to leverage Make America Great Again, which, you know, I thought their logo would be Make America Drunk Again. But
well, I'm going to interrupt you and tell you once again, Joe, you have made the show great again.
Am I the Donald Trump of media sidekicks?
Yeah, you are. You are. No, you're much better than that. As a matter of fact, if I can't make it one night, you'll be hosting it. I want to thank Mike Kim, without whom I could not do this show.
He's the best.
Doug Newsom, our engineer, and especially you. Now, you tell folks where they can hear you tomorrow night, where they can get your news vandal, and what they can do to find you until the next time they find you here.
Well, you can go to American Freedom Radio, The Ocelli Effect, Ocelli, O-C-H-L-E-O-E-L-L-I, Ocelli Effect. Just go to newsvandal.com, N-E-W-S-V-A-N-D-A-L, newsvandal.com. It'll pop up. You can sign up for the rundown. You should get the rundown. It's 5 days a week. I give you the weekends off, but it's all the news that fits.
Well, again, Joe, thank you very, very much. Can't wait to talk to you next time. Folks, thank you so much for listening. Love having you here. Have a terrific night. Good night. Good luck. Good night. Bye-bye.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 sunny. I love you.